morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, back from a couple of week vacation, a nostalgia tour of my home state of Oklahoma. But it was a really good vacation. A lot has been happening since I've been on vacation. I really haven't listened to any news in 2 weeks. So I'm going to have to defer to Karen here to introduce our guests and talk and ask them questions. I'd like to know, my question would be just how's the governor doing with her vetoes and so forth and so on. But Karen, go ahead and introduce our guest.
Yeah, we've got on the air today Senator Mitzi Epstein, who's the leader, the minority leader of the Democrats in the Arizona Senate. She's been in the legislature since, I think, 2016 now on a bunch of things. She's a computer analyst, a computer person, small business owner, and has been a really loud voice for small business and for education in all the years she's been down there in the legislature. So she took over as Senate leader earlier this year when Senator Tehran resigned to run for a seat in Congress. And so we're partly through the legislative session. It's certainly been a strange one. They've taken long breaks. Right now they're on a hiatus until June 12th. They did pass a budget. That was the big thing. Now they've taken some time off, and they'll be back to try to pass some more bad bills. And if anyone's been following this, I think the governor has broken the record for Arizona governors in bills she's vetoed. But she did sign a budget in the last few weeks, and it was one that some Democrats said yes to some parts, and some Democrats said no to the whole budget, and some Democrats said no to parts of it. It was not what anybody would have wanted, but the governor did sign it. So maybe we can just start with what did you think of the budget, Mitzi, just as in general. Mitzi,
are you there? Do we lose her? She seems to be connected.
There, now I am.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there you are. Yeah.
Technical difficulties.
Yeah.
always nice to talk on your show. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah.
Yes, we have passed a nearly $18 billion budget, and it is, the good news is there are a lot of good projects that will be funded, and the bad news is that they're all just one time. So on the one hand, there will be a lot of bridges and roads that will be built in various parts across the state, and we will make sure, I personally made sure, that our K-12 schools have some inflation funding. And that's the good news. The bad news is we don't have anything next year. So it is going to be rough going next year. We'll see what we end up with after all the actual funding has been spent as opposed to how it looks in the budget. But mostly it's a budget that we, as you know, Karen, because we've been school board buddies for such a long time, K-12 education is, to me, one of the most important responsibilities of the state budget. So for my perspective, when I first began to negotiate in earnest on the budget, number one, we had to make sure that we brought K-12 funding up to something close to inflation growth. And we got something in the ballpark of 6% growth. Inflation is more like a little over 7%. So unfortunately, our schools are still going to be behind the eight ball on inflation. But we should have did everything I could to try to get it closer. And apparently a lot of these little pet projects were more important to my Republican colleagues than making sure that students are supported appropriately in their grade schools.
How did this work out? Do Democrats feel they got some really good stuff? Why did the governor sign the bill if there were so many doubts about certain sections of it?
Well, it got done, and I guess that's a good reason to sign it. Getting a budget done is an important thing. We want to make sure that we have our agencies open and that they know how to plan. And that's, there's a lot to be said for just making sure that gets done. Aside from that, there are some wonderful points of pride in this budget. In addition to the K-12 funding for just ongoing covering inflation, we have another $200 million in there for school buildings. And as you may know, our grade school buildings have fallen into disrepair again because the legislature has refused to fund the school facilities board funding, and that's left roofs in need of repair. So there are at least four roofs in rural areas that are schools that are going to get repaired because of this budget. So that's a good step forward. There's also unprecedented, historically large amounts of funding invested for affordable housing and homelessness. So we put $150 million into the Housing Trust Fund, and that is just a fund where we put money for the Department of Housing to determine the best use for it. So they will use some of it to build more homes, and they will use some of it for emergency needs for people who are just need a bridge for a few months if they're behind on the rent to avoid being evicted. And we created a brand new fund that we're very excited about called the Homelessness Fund that will put $20 million right away this fiscal year towards helping those who are homeless to find the shelter and also get the wraparound services that they need to get to the kind of home that they want to have. So after this year is done, then there's another $40 million for next year's budget in that homelessness fund.
Is that money
hot in Phoenix right now?
Is that money that communities apply for with grants, or is money distributed through nonprofits? How does that money actually get spent to help people?
If the state agencies are actually working that out, and they have some wonderful coalitions working on that, it will all flow through the Department of Housing, and I would expect that there may be nonprofit grants available. And the agencies, of course, will be dealing with most of it.
Okay. Yeah, we'll just hope.
Yeah, in my travels, we stayed in a couple of, I guess you'd call it transitional neighborhoods in Airbnbs. So homelessness is really a problem across the country. And I see governments working. I mean, we lived across from, stayed across from a project that they were rebuilding some older buildings, the city of Tulsa was. But the amount of homelessness in the neighborhood we stayed in was pretty surprising. And some of the folks are, you know, in really, really bad shape. You know, we had a naked man jump out of a stairwell that led down to the basement of a church that was being sold. And things like that, and the whole neighborhood can be kind of a weird. I'm glad that people are, you know, homesteading them, and I think both the homes that we stayed in were owned by young women. How best to spend the money? So you're sort of leaving that to the state agencies to figure out how to use the money the most effectively.
Right, that's generally how the budgeting goes, is that we provide the money to the various agencies that get it done. So housing, done by the Department of Housing. The Department of Corrections also will be getting some long-awaited, an infusion of one-time funding to, in part, to address the lawsuits that you've no doubt heard about in the headlines that our Department of Corrections, and that's our prisons, basically.
Yeah, those have been lawsuits about health care. Yeah. You know, the quality of health care for people who are incarcerated in Arizona. And it's a lot of those lawsuits have covered insufficient and inadequate health care. So hopefully the money gets, you know, directed to address those issues. Yeah.
Right. And even there's $35 million in there for HVAC replacements in our prisons. You know, I've gone to visit our prisons a few times, and some of them are okay, but others are just incredibly uncomfortable. And I don't think it's humane for anybody to be living in terribly uncomfortable air conditions, meaning if it's too hot, it's too cold, whatever it is, the HVAC systems do need repair. But even for those who have no sympathy for folks who are incarcerated, the people we're asking to work there deserve a decent environment. So this is $35 million just to work on HVAC for our prisons is long overdue, and I was really glad to see that in the budget, too.
It sounds like a few of these things like that and some of the school facilities funding for schools are just a chance to catch up on many years of no funding for upkeep and maintenance for some of these, you know, for schools, for prisons from in prior Republican budgets. So it's nice to see that they're getting back to the idea that that school, all kinds of public facilities need infusions of funds for upgrade and maintenance and just routine things along the way. Too many years we've left, dropped that down to close to zero as if, you don't need to do that. And we all know roofs and HVAC and, all those issues need to deteriorate. And we've spent money. I know in the past we've agreed that, hey, bridges and roads need money. We haven't always agreed that schools, prisons, and other state buildings need upkeep.
Yeah, the problem is if you don't do preventive maintenance, then you end up with a bigger bill down the line for the collapsed structure. Was the governor right to sign the bill that she did, Nitzy?
Well, I would have liked to have negotiated further. I think that we had, 2, 4, 6 more weeks that we could have gotten some more things into the budget. The governor's style was to get this budget done and then negotiate other things like the Prop 400 question separately from the budget. So,
and the Prop 400 for people,
that's
issues of transportation bills in Maricopa County. And that's issues for extending a tax in Maricopa County to fund transportation issues. And, those are, which has been a bone of contention, because that was originally was going to be a ballot question. And that didn't work, for Maricopa County, where, because it affects them more than it affects the rest of us and those issues.
One of the big sort of hate on issues up here in Sedona is the amount of traffic. And I guess the lack of traffic funding. It seems to me that they've done, the local people have done a good job in uptown Sedona. We were able to drive through it in a high traffic time much more quickly than we used to. And, that remains a kind of, sore point with Sedonans certainly. Will any of this money perk down to our, projects and stuff here in northern Arizona?
Well, I don't know all of the roads in northern Arizona, I confess, but I know that, blacktopping, fixing potholes has been of great concern. At least the people have been contacting me, and I was at a press conference where that was the number one question for the governor. What are you going to do about the potholes? And yes. Especially northern Arizona has had a lot of problems with resurfacing needs, and those are in the budget. You should be seeing those getting the attention they deserve. But the thing is that a lot of that is actually the kind of thing that ADOT normally should be doing in an ongoing way. And the trouble has been that our Republican colleagues have just defunded so many things in state government that are supposed to be just ongoing. And so, for instance, Pima County is one of the worst for these cost shifts. They're the worst victim, if you will. They will now shoulder an additional $16 million in cost shifts, things that the state should be paying for, but the state budget shifted it onto them. And so that's actually going to be a total of $112 million now the state should be paying for. Pima County is going to have to use their property taxes to get that funding paid. And that's what we've seen time and again is state legislators thinking they're heroes because they cut taxes. But then the counties still have to pay the roads. They still have to provide the county sheriff. They still have to do so much work. And the city's the same. They have to do so many of the things that the state should be paying for. There's a road in down here in Mesa. It is a state road. The city said they would take it over if the state would just bring it up to some sort of road standard. And the state budget has never done that. And so there is this, you know, road that simply is in disrepair. And it's starting to become more than just a little bit of a problem for everybody in the neighborhood. And those kinds of things happen again and again, where the local municipality has to fill in what, because the state budget has refused, the state legislature under majority party rule, which is the Republican Party.
So this
is choosing to not fund cities and counties, not do cover their state responsibilities. So city and counties have to fill in.
So this one, I know for years now we've had massive tax cuts in every budget. Was this budget right in line with what's been going on for about the last couple of decades?
Well, Karen, you're right. They've managed to find, even in a year where we have no ongoing funding coming up, so they can't make an ongoing tax cut, they managed to come up with something anyway. So it started out that our Republican colleagues just wanted to say, as you know, they sort of divvied up the budget by saying, well, to each of their Republican legislators, you decide how to spend $20 million, and you decide how to spend $20 million, and so on down the line. They each got a bucket of $20 million that they could direct.
And that sounds like the worst way to budget anything, you know.
Pardon?
It sounds like the worst way to budget anything, you know. Here's $20 million for you.
I would agree with you. You know, Old McDonald's Farm, here bucket, there bucket, everywhere bucket, bucket. That's not looking at your total responsibility as a state, but that's what they did. And so what we ended up with is many different pet projects. Some of these projects are things that should have been done a long time ago had there been better budgeting all along. But in particular, several of these legislators decided to pool their money and do a rebate to people, just send money to people. And they just wanted it to be anybody who's paid taxes in the last 3 years gets a few hundred dollars. And Democrats, of course, find that to be silly and would much prefer that we take care of our responsibilities, public health, public education, public safety. But the Republicans were adamant. They want to get do some kind of what they call the tax rebate. And it would be one time. So we were able to negotiate them. The governor really worked hard on negotiating it somewhat towards people who actually have some need. Let's make it an equitable tax rebate, not just a willy-nilly throwing money out the window. So what it will be is a tax rebate for people with dependents, either anybody who depends on you, obviously children, but also if you have a senior or somebody who lives in your home and they're dependent on you, you'll get a few hundred dollars per dependent. Now, all of that sounds pretty good and sounds like something that Republicans like it because it's a tax rebate in their minds. Democrats put our spin on it by addressing it to people who have more need because we're all interested in investing in their children. But the weird thing about it is only for people who have paid some kind of taxes, who have had a tax liability of at least $1 in the last 3 years. And the happy news is if you're a person with dependents and you've had at least $1 of state liability in state tax, income taxes, then you're just going to get a check in the mail. And that's pretty terrific. For every family with kids that needs some child care help, this will be a little bit of help. The weird thing is, though, for those families with the lowest income, they might not get anything. So if you've had income in the past 3 years that was below, say, the standard deductible amount, then you would have not had a liability. And our families with the very least are not eligible to get this. So it will help our most wealthy families, and it will be a nice boost for middle-income families, but not those with the very least, which is a head-scratcher. And some of those who will not qualify would be active military, because active military can deduct their total pay from income tax forms, and therefore they don't have any income tax, apparently, in Arizona. And therefore, they're not eligible for this. So on the one hand, it certainly isn't designed the way the Democrats would have designed it. To be honest with you, I would have much preferred just let's provide much better child care subsidies for people with children. So not designed the way that Democrats would have, but a fairly decent compromise and that is the tax rebate that is in this year's budget.
What other compromises do you think that Democrats had to agree to that were really useful for the public? This one sounds sort of bad from the budgeting point of view, but the state's facilities and stuff is all underfunded, and then you're giving people money back, you know, so it seems a little weird. What other compromises did you think that were worked out between the governor, you guys, and the state house and senate and the Republicans?
Well, the Republicans were, you know, happy to go along with our suggestions, the governor's suggestions, in fact, to make sure that we take care of our responsibilities to the Department of Corrections, the expansion of I-17 is going to be funded with state fundings, as well as the expansion of I-10. That's Phoenix to Casa Grande. These things are going to happen that were the governor's priorities, and she provided some really great leadership to get a lot of basic state needs done in the budget. And, you know, some smaller things, like the Supreme Court needs a little bit of extra funding for a new judge in Yavapai County, for instance, and the state budget looks after that. So there's a number of things that the Republicans agreed to that were okay with the governor's suggestion, and the Republicans agreed to them.
After that budget is, what's going to be left, like in the rainy day fund? I mean, it's always, you know, talked about that some years we spend that, some years we don't. How did this year work out into what sort of left in that, be in that fund to cover actual emergencies that might come up?
So we still have nearly $1 billion in the rainy day fund. And while that's not the 10% that some folks think we ought to have, since we do not have any ongoing discretionary funding, we all agreed, let's not make this be the year that we do an investment into the rainy day fund. So it still continues to have right around $1 billion in it, and that's a good cushion.
Yeah, Steve.
Let me ask a kind of simple question. What's coming up next? You voted for a very, very long recess while you... people go on vacation, I guess. It's a great time to go on vacation.
Just to be clear,
I just did it. But
when they made that motion to adjourn, I voted no.
Okay.
there are procedural things on the floor that where they'll say we're going to, move to not come back for 3 weeks.
So what's
next?
A voice vote, so I sit up there in my leadership seat and say nay. Let's stay and work. Yeah. But. Was overruled by the majority.
So what's left to finish up? I know beyond the transportation issues for Maricopa County, what other big bills are left that they need to come back and vote on? And are they another batch of bills that the governor is going to veto, the social sort of issues, the school issues, as opposed to the... I mean, obviously, the transportation issues for Maricopa County are something that everybody has to figure out something to do. But what other big bills are they still going to be voting on when you come back in June?
I do not know of anything in particular that really needs to be done in June, off the top of my head. This Prop 100 at Maricopa County needs to be figured out, because Maricopa County is now 5 of the 7 million people in Arizona, so we need to make sure that as anybody passes through, that we have the right infrastructure to do it. And one of the big pieces of contention that your listeners will be heartened to hear about, I think, is that, you know, Maricopa County, the various cities in the county, have worked hard to develop public transportation. And I was at the Capitol recently, where a local chamber of commerce was visiting, and we were having a discussion of what's important, and Prop 400 came up, and they said, yes, we absolutely need that, because our workers take public transit to get to work. And another person raised their hand and said, our students take public transportation to get to school. And this is the Chamber of Commerce saying this. So public transit really is important. And in really dense parts of cities, light rail is the most efficient kind of public transit. But that is the part of Prop 400 that my Republican colleagues are balking at. They're not wanting to allow the people who live in Maricopa County to pay for higher taxes to cover things like public transit. They'll pay, Republicans will pay for roads from now and forever, but public transit seems to bother them for some reason, even though it is incredibly efficient and helps keep our economy running. But aside from that, there is not a whole lot going on in the way of big bills. But there's two more things in the budget that I wanted to point out, and it has to do with our schools. So Senator Alston, Leela Alston, had a bill for community gardens in schools. And I had a bill to plant trees in schools. And both of those will be done. So our schools will be able to reach out to the Department of Education to get grants for planting trees in schoolyards, which especially down where it gets very hot at any time of year, trees are a really important factor in reducing extreme heat. And my main purpose, I'm going to be honest with you, was to help kids who have needs to reduce extreme heat in schoolyards, but also it's one of the best things we can do for climate change. As you look around, what can we do for clean air? Planting more trees just gets the job done in such a very efficient way. So I'm really excited that we are going to plant trees for kids with the money in this budget this year. I've been advocating for that for about 2 or 3 years. And it's pretty exciting. I'm happy to see it happen this year.
Some of the state parks, small and large, also the ones near Sedona, seem stressed. Is there any money in the budget to increase funding for, say, traffic management in some of the parks, or making them more upgrading the facilities, I guess, is the broad question.
In our state parks, is that what?
Yeah, state parks and recreational, any kind of recreational area, is that getting taken care of, I guess is my question. Because
not as well as it should be. The request this year for the Heritage Park Fund, for instance, was $20 million, and they asked for it to be annual. We did manage to get $5 million in the budget for them, but that's all there is. And it will be one time. We'll see what happens going forward. I expect we'll manage to get another $5 million at least next year, but they really need the ongoing dedicated funding, and that has been lacking in so many budgets year after year. But yes, I mean, the state parks and so on, recreational areas are enormously important to families who want to go have a wonderful day, and to our tourism industry, which is so important for our economy.
Yeah, so many people use the park, driving down by Slide Rock. It's just filled with people waiting to get in. I don't know about traffic management, but the parking lot's not all that big. Hundreds of people sitting down along Oak Creek looking like they're having a good time. But it looks like the state parks, I mean, I'm just guessing, are used by a lot of people from a lot of different places. So the fact that you live in Maricopa doesn't mean that you're not using parks up here in the Sedona area. And it must be a tremendous relief to get out of the heat in summer to go up to a spring-fed, you know, park.
Just anywhere up in the high country.
Anywhere in the high country.
Yeah,
but
right.
I mean, I think people think the parks are doing something for local people, but really they're used statewide. And there's so many families. I don't know if they're the richest folks in the world, but I don't think so. But, you know, they're up here and it looks like having a great time. I just wonder about the traffic management, or, you know, whether people have been looking into what we can do. They're getting a heavy usage.
You know, they've been underfunded since the 2008 budget crisis, when they tried to sort of zero out state park funding and talked about closing parks and things. And I know it's gotten better since then, but it's like so many things in Arizona, education, the parks that were during that crisis money was cut that everybody understood had to be cut, but it's never come back to the levels it should be at. We're still playing catch up in so many of these areas that are beyond, like I said, beyond just building the, you know, repairing the roads, all those other issues of that are somewhat social.
That's the impression I get is a massive usage of the parks. And even though I didn't go in and check and see how it was affecting things, clearly, you know, there's long lines of cars waiting to get in Slide Rock. And I understand it's the most popular park in a state park. But that's one thing that I think that would be helpful, because they're so widely used by everybody, and so are the municipal parks and stuff. There really are oases to deal with our climate.
Just one thing, Ms. Caesar, we're getting ready to finish this year. The governor vetoed more bills than any governor of Arizona has ever vetoed. Most of them, a lot of things to do on the sort of right-wing Republican social agenda, on school agenda, some, you know, bills that most of us feel are sort of crazy, and she vetoed those. The budget next year, we're looking at essentially the same people. You know, there's not going to be any difference in the, a few of the names are changing, you know, because there's always some people who, you know, leave at the end of the session for various, but they're going to be replaced by people of the same party, and the few that have happened by people who essentially have the same views. So what do you think, we're going to be looking at anything different for next year? Is there sort of anything we can do between now and next January to sort of influence the what happens in the legislature,
It looks like the legislature spends an amazing amount of time, Karen and Misty, dealing with these social goals that represent
a small
part of the people. I don't think people are really interested in them. I think they're, you know, tail wagging the dog.
Well, they're
stuff,
talking points for re-election.
Yeah.
So do you think, do you see anything that's going to be different for next year? What can we do between now and then to maybe influence the, rather than have a carbon copy repeat?
You know, there was a reporter who said that Governor Hobbs is the veto queen, but I maintain only because our speaker and president are the bad bill kings. These bad bills that they've been setting up are just ridiculous. And, you know, in the time I've been watching the legislature and the time I've been in the legislature, really ridiculously bad bills have not been sent to the governor. But, you know, they'll hear them in the committee and then they'll stop, because the leadership in the Republican Party in the past would say, let's not embarrass ourselves by putting forward this bill that is not well thought out or is such an extreme idea. But this year, they have put forward everything. And so the bills that have been vetoed have fallen into several categories. For instance, those, as you mentioned, that are on social issues. We don't need any bills to ban drag queens from performing. It's ridiculous. And we certainly do not want to stop students in high school from being called their preferred pronouns. We had bills that would do that, and so fortunately, the governor said veto. And those are just extreme bills. That's one category that, thank goodness, she is there to stop them. Another one has been, we already have a law to do that category. So there have been, we've had, I don't know how many bills that have come through the judiciary, where it seems our Republican colleagues want to make a point about how righteous and kind they are, I guess, in a weird way, or that they're on top of crime. They're tough on crime, is trying to be their message. But many of these bills are just, but we already have another law that does that. You're making a very specific law about a very specific thing, but we have a general law that already does that. They can be prosecuted under this other law. And so the governor has said veto on that, because we don't need to make up extra laws just so that some lawmaker can say, I got a bill passed. And then there's the unimplementable laws, the ones that just have not been well thought out. Just some lawmaker decided to, they wanted their name in a headline, but they didn't thought to do a stakeholder process. And so the bill just doesn't work. You know, you can't have people do things that are contrary. And, you know, bills that are would make a law that is contrary to another law, and yet this bill got passed. She has vetoed those. So the just the really poor quality of legislation that they've sent to the governor's office, I don't know. It's embarrassing to the Republican Party, if you ask me.
But they seem to keep doing it. I guess the payoff of their pleasing their core constituencies, even when a bill is unconstitutional or even when it's unenforceable or even when it's going to cause more chaos than not doing anything, they still do it. And I guess with a Democratic governor, then all the stops went out, right? Then they can just go with anything.
Yeah, it does seem like
doing.
Yeah, some of these bills were they knew that they could pass. They knew the governor would veto them, so that nothing would ever happen. So they could go on Fox News and get interviewed and said, "I passed this bill to do, you know, this bill about transgender students," knowing that it was going to get vetoed. Yes, just so they could get their talking point that says, "I passed the bill," and they never say, "Well, right. But the governor vetoed it." So, yeah, nobody ever, that next sentence is there. So people listening to them can think that, wow, these people in Arizona are doing all these things. No, they're, you know, we're not like Florida on some of these issues or Texas because they're not getting, you know, they're not becoming law, but that doesn't stop people from bragging about having passed them. Yeah.
The problem,
you know,
I always see is
a really good position here in the States that we don't even realize that we're when our governor vetoes a law, it stays vetoed because our legislature is so close. We're only off by one vote, one person in the House, one person in the Senate from having equal, and two people off from being the majority. So, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans in the state legislature in Arizona are very close. And therefore, once our Democratic governor vetoes a bad bill, it stays vetoed. Other states are not so lucky. They've had situations where the Democratic governor vetoes a bill and they override it on purely partisan. The Republican Party just overrides it all by themselves because they have supermajority. So here in Arizona, where we have such a nice split, we are very fortunate, and I really appreciate all that our governor, Katie Hobbs, is doing.
Yeah, it's changed things, hasn't
yes.
it? It's changed things having a Democratic governor.
It's changed things on issues. I mean, we've all, you know, organizations that I belong to that do lobbying and do things, you know, on different issues have sort of said, well, the governor's going to veto a lot of this stuff. So rather than getting all of our members excited to go on RTS or write a letter to the governor or write a letter to you about some bill, let's try to work on some, you know, structural things to make sure that we flip the legislature in 2024. You know, because we have that backstop of knowing that the governor will veto some of these things, and so let's work on educating the voters on what those bills really mean, rather than having to get everybody up to go down and demonstrate at the Capitol. You know, we can spend our energy on.
So many of the bills, particularly the social bills, strike me as just lacking compassion. Maybe there is a real issue there that should be addressed, and maybe there are people on one side or another. But gender issues, there's not a sense of compassion, and we can disagree on some stuff, but it's a lack of compassion permeates our legislation, lawmaking. And I'm glad to see that there's some break with that.
Yeah, because on those issues, there's things that people discuss, you know, on issues, let's say, about, you know, transgenders and sports that may be real issues, but they don't apply to 11-year-olds. They apply to teenagers and, you know, competing at the college level.
Yeah, and there might be some sports that these issues do play a part. But
if they don't apply to 10 and 11-year-olds who want to play in AYSO soccer or who want to play on their school's fourth grade basketball team.
But it just turns into kind of hate stuff, Karen. They're just hating on transgender kids. I mean, I doesn't seem like anyway, Missy. Let's get back to questions. Most of the legislation for this year is done, right? And coming back in June, is it going to be a long session, short session, or?
Oh, if only I had a crystal ball that could tell me that. That would be great. That's what we really want. So I don't think there's a whole lot more to be done. I think this year's session is pretty much on the shelf and done. There, as you may know, the House passed 95 bills in one day just before we broke for recess. The real tragedy of that is not only were obviously many of those bills very controversial and just, as you described it, full of hate. Just, you know, find more ways to ostracize people and make some sets of people the other from everybody else. It's just, they were wrong. But in addition to that, going through 95 bills in just a few hours means none of them got the full debate. None of them, you know, we call it COW, Committee of the Whole, when we are all on the floor to debate a bill. And that is the only opportunity that we have to all debate a bill. Aside from that, it's just a committee. And so going through 95 bills all in one day was irresponsible. And so I look forward to the time when we can have a Democratic majority. And I look for, if nothing else, just a much smarter workflow in which we make sure we bring in the public to ask everybody outside who will be affected by a law, what do you think about this? How will it affect your life? And in that way, I think that we can make much better laws. And then we don't need to have days when we try to vote 95 bills through because they're afraid they won't have the votes tomorrow. So,
yeah, because nobody can possibly read all those bills in that much time, and we've seen that in past legislatures where they come into a time crunch and they pass a whole lot of bills, and the Republican governor signs them all, and then you start out the next legislative session with bills to fix the problems on the bills that were passed last year because nobody really thought about the consequences. Nobody really thought of, you know, the details, and when you rush things through, nobody can possibly think about the things. In fact, most of the people probably voted on things they hadn't read at all beyond the title. And that's, you know, it doesn't matter what party you are or who, you know, what's good. That's not a good way to do business. I mean, you've seen that in the past. You don't want to spend half your legislative session going back to solve the problem. Looks like we're just about out of time, Mitzi, so we got to...
Do we have some announcements for some of our supporters, like DOOR?
DOOR just had their regular monthly meeting this past Friday on gun control. They had a dinner dance on Saturday, which I was unable to attend, but I guess was a very successful fundraiser.
So we'll
follow up on what their topics are for next month as we get closer to that. Yeah.
We encourage everybody to subscribe to the Yavapai County Democratic newsletter. Extremely well done. So is our more local ones in the Verde Valley. A good way to understand what's going on with DOOR and all the other Democratic groups, there's quite a few now that are really active, Karen, is to go on the websites and
sign up for the newsletters.
Sign up for the newsletter. You'll actually learn a lot, and they're well written, and they're not really terribly boring or anything. Yes. It's not going to be a horrible experience. So we would really like to thank our sponsors. We're heading into another session where we're going to have a fundraiser and raise some money. So if you can support our radio show directly, that would be very, very good. All the podcasts we've done over all these years are available on our website. And we're increasingly using our Facebook page to alert people to what's going on, to commentary. You'll find Gary LeMaster's summaries of the shows there. All right, folks, thank you very much for being with us. Join us next week and have a great day. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.